During an interview, von der Leyen stated, Russia will descend into economic, financial, and technological decay, while Ukraine is marching towards the European future. This is what I see. Also, specifically about Ukrainian possible EU's membership, she said, it will not, as usual, be a matter of years, but I think a matter of weeks. On this trip, both von der Leyen and Borrell greatly praised the military aspect of the search for resolution of the conflict, asserting on several occasions that Ukraine must defeat Russia. Apparently, Europeans are abdicating any diplomatic or pro-peace stance and adopting a stance that is absolutely in favor of victory by arms, which, according to most experts, is virtually impossible for Ukraine. Borrell, in this meeting, promised that he would immediately send an additional aid of 500 million euros for Kiev to buy weapons. Previously, the EU had already sent another 1 billion euros. The diplomat also made statements implying that he considers the current European support budget for Ukraine to be low, comparing it with EU spending on imports from Russia. On another occasion, Borrell made clear his anti-Russian radicalism and his pro-war stance, stating categorically that this war must be won on the battlefield. Considering Borrell's high position in the EU and his direct influence on the conflict, the statement sounds really dangerous, as Europe appears willing to finance a major escalation of the conflict. The main problem, however, is that the EU is not the only side interested in financing such an escalation. The UK has shown several times that it aims to take the conflict forward until an eventual Ukrainian victory happens. Recently, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson also visited Kiev and met with Zelensky and other Ukrainian authorities. The stance of the British leader was very similar to that of the Europeans, with Johnson also committing to send packages of military aid to Kiev. Before traveling to Ukraine, the Prime Minister had already announced that he would send aid worth $130 million in weapons to Kiev. Among the weapons in the package will be anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles, precision ammunition, night vision equipment. On Saturday, April 10th, however, already in Ukraine, Johnson pledged another $500 million in aid, which shows that he is really increasing his support for Zelensky's war plans. It is also important to remember that before the first round of negotiations between the Russian and Ukrainian diplomatic delegations in Ankara, Johnson had called Zelensky and instructed the Ukrainian president not to admit that his diplomats gave too much during the talks. Johnson seems very determined to assert that the victory can only come through arms, instructing the Ukrainian authorities to avoid effective diplomatic dialogue. It is curious to see how Westerners want to carry this conflict forward, with the troops not being directly involved in the fighting. The position of European and British leaders is very comfortable, sending money and weapons to Ukrainians to fight a war they cannot win, only to continue destabilizing the Russian strategic environment and delaying the inevitable victory of the Moscow's special operation. For the West, Ukraine is a hopeless case, and the longer the conflict lasts, the better. This is a way to gain time in the face of a deferred defeat scenario. Ukrainians are just serving as instruments in a game that is already not theirs. Also, it should be mentioned that if Kyiv continues to receive heavy weapons and launch increasingly aggressive offensives, the Kremlin will be compelled to change its strategy, possibly using more of its military capacity, whose potential has been very controlled during the operation, in order to avoid larger-scale damage to the Ukrainian people. In this sense, Western military and financial aid directly threatens the peace of the entire world, which is suffering the consequences of the conflict. The longer Zelensky resists, the more sufferings the Ukrainian people will have to endure to carry on a conflict where Kyiv has already been partially defeated. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's well recognised that Western media outlets are consistently biased against the struggle of the Palestinian people. But how does this work in practice? In today's programme, we'll examine the impact of Zionist infiltration on the media. What role do Zionist journalists and organisations play in neutering independent coverage of Palestine? We'll be focusing on the situation in Britain and in Germany, and I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report on the infiltration of four British newspapers by Zionist activists.
People's ability to grasp what exactly is happening to the Palestinians is determined by what they read about it. What they read about it is dictated by those who write it. Today we take a close look at how key figures at the most prominent British newspapers are influenced by the Israel lobby. The Daily Mail, together with its website, The Mail Online, are estimated to reach 4.1 million people on a daily basis. Very few are aware that its longtime city editor, Alex Brummer, is actually an Israel lobbyist. Simultaneous to his job at the Mail, he is also the chair of the Israeli regime-funded Abraham Initiatives, which claims in its trustees report that it advances synergy between Israeli bodies and respective agencies and institutions in the UK. Sounds like a lobby group, right? Well, here he is at Israel lobby group BICOM's We Believe in Israel event. Listen to what he says.
We need BICOM, we need the toolkit, and we need it urgently because, you know, there's a tide of opinion which has turned against Israel, and it's going to be very hard to turn it back.
The Sun newspaper is estimated to have a daily readership of 3.7 million and is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation Group. We know that in 2007, the News Corp Foundation was listed as a funder of the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in Israeli settlements. Murdoch himself also serves on the board of oil and gas exploration company Genie Energy. Genie Energy has been granted contracts by the Israeli regime in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. But what about the journalists at The Sun? Trevor Kavanagh, former political and later associate editor of The Sun, has a very close relationship with the Israel lobby group BICOM. He spoke at several We Believe in Israel events in support of the faction, and when he was criticised for lamenting what he called the Muslim problem in the UK, Israel lobbyist and part-time journalist Alex Brummer leapt to his defence. In the aftermath of Protective Edge, Kavanagh willingly stepped forward at a We Believe in Israel event that I chaired to staunchly make the case for Israel's actions and to criticise media bias. The Guardian is widely thought to be the progressive alternative to these right-wing class war rags. However, what we find is a newspaper which has been subjugated significantly by the Israel lobby. It has a daily readership of 3.5 million, and Jonathan Friedland was an executive editor there between 2014 and 2016, during which he also spoke at several BICOM events, including one named the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference, where he lovingly hosted a conversation session with current Israeli President Isaac Herzog. He has also spoken at events for the New Israel Fund and has his work publicly supported by the Israeli embassy in the UK. Sounds too close for comfort. Lastly, but never least, is the touchstone of the British establishment, the Times newspaper. It has a daily readership of almost 500,000 people. Brownman Maddox was the foreign editor of the Times, simultaneous to being a non-executive director of the Chatham House think tank, which is funded by the Israeli embassy. She later went on to be an editor of Prospect magazine, and simultaneously to that, hosted current Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, a part of the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference. Today, Maddox is the director of the Institute for Government think tank, which is funded by the Israeli government, and also Lord Sainsbury, who has pumped over £1 million into the Labour Friends of Israel lobby group. This is simultaneous to Maddox writing for the Financial Times, naturally. So here we have evidence of British newspapers with a collective daily readership of almost 13 million being staffed by people with what seems to be quite serious conflicts of interest. Nothing to see here.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic on Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dr. Ramzi Baroud. He's a journalist and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He's also authored 5 books. His latest one is called These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. Ramzi is a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs in Istanbul. And he joins us from Seattle, where it's very early in the morning. Welcome to the show. David, if I could just to start with you. Now, I've heard a lot about this sort of propaganda network pushing certain lines in the media. Where's that directed from, do you think? And are there specific organizations behind it? And how is it being organized?
Well, you see these journalists who, if you like, are Zionist infiltrators in the media. And really, we should think of them as being that kind of character. They're not journalists who happen to have sympathies. These are people who are infiltrating on behalf of a hostile foreign state, the State of Israel. But there are also a number of other ways in which the State of Israel tries to influence the media in this country. Of course, there's the government, the State of Israel itself, which has its own propaganda and public relations apparatus, but they also have a number of organizations in this country which are known usually as pro-Israel lobby groups. BICOM has been mentioned in the film there, and it's the main PR agency for in favor of Israel in this country. People think of it, as I said, as an Israel lobby group, but of course it's really an arm of the Israeli state. It functions very closely with the embassy and indeed with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, also with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs when it was in charge of anti-BDS activities in this country. So when you hear people at BICOM speaking, really what you're hearing is the messages that come from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You're not hearing some independent British Zionist organization. You're hearing the views of a hostile foreign state. And that's the important thing here. And what's important about the understanding propaganda networks is that they are there to direct particular sorts of messages which the infiltrators in the media, the journalists who happen to be Zionists, will pick up and spread.
Ramzi, I wonder if we could come to you now, if we can get you up on the screen. I wonder if you could maybe tell us about the situation in the media in the United States. And I mean, is this a problem, do you think, with the individual rogue Zionist journalists, or is it a systematic problem, do you think?
Of course, it's a very much a systematic problem. In fact, the United States kind of pretty much define the genre of media bias, and they kind of brought it down to a science, more or less. On the one hand, you have this very idea of the very normal Israel. Israel is not being examined or not being tested in any way. Israel defines the narratives on democracy, on normalcy, on civilization, on human rights, and it's constantly in a state of self-defense. Now, this is not something that has happened overnight It's an institutional propaganda that goes back many, many years, particularly after the war of 1967, and even in the early 80s with the rise of powerful lobby groups like AIPAC and others. While Palestinians are constantly being portrayed as the enemy, being portrayed not just as an enemy of Israel and therefore enemy of democracy and civilization and human rights, but also the enemy of everything that America stands for, the so-called American values. So in other words, the Americans have gone several steps ahead of everyone else in the West, which is linking the United States interest with American interest, and therefore, Palestinians are seen as not just at odds with Israel, but also at direct odds with the United States, with its policies, and with, again, so-called American values.
So there's clearly a major issue there, then, that you're setting out, Ramsey. And yet we hear about these situations like the columnist, Barry Weiss, resigning from the New York Times, alleging anti-Semitism. She even talked about a new McCarthyism. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, if we think about it in terms of superstructures, if you think about Israel's presence in the United States media, academia, and of course, government and foreign policy, you will find that they have created a new normal in which any form of criticism of Israel is not even allowed to be discussed, dissected, or anything. So in their minds, they feel like this is the normal. This is the status quo of thinking on this particular subject. Any deviation from that thinking, that for us is outrageous because it does violate all norms of fact-checking, good journalism, good common sense. But again, for them, it's a generational issue. Any criticism of Israel, be it, for example, emphasizing the latest Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports on Israeli apartheid and violations of human rights in Palestine, just the mere mention of that is considered, an act of anti-Semitism as far as the pro-Israel camp is concerned. So in other words, they are very spoiled in terms of their expectations, and they actually have no idea that they have already checked all the boxes and they have everything they want to have in terms of the dominance of their narrative over any others when it comes to Israel and the Middle East.
I mean, David, one of the worst outlets for this problem in the UK, certainly, and I think it's actually distributed in the United States as well in any event, is The Guardian. Maybe you could say a little bit about The Guardian. I mean, what's happened to The Guardian? I mean, it used to be kind of seen as a, kind of radical newspaper that sort of championed free speech, but it seems to have lost the plot, doesn't it?
Well, The Guardian has a long, long history of cozying up to imperial power and to the British state, but it had a period where it was more liberal, where it was able to do more investigative journalism. Of course, in recent years, they shut down their investigative journalism unit. And under the influence of someone like Jonathan Friedland, who, of course, is very strongly connected to the Israeli government, the Guardian has become much more pro-Israel and much less receptive to any kind of criticism of the state of Israel. They have a number of journalists in there who are in that kind of position. The chief political correspondent, for example, Jessica Elgott, who has risen from nothing, from working at the JC some years ago through the Huff Post, and into this role in The Guardian. She was on record recently at a Board of Deputies meeting saying that nobody should use the term Zionist. It's not allowed to use the term Zionist. And this is at the cutting edge of current Israel lobby thinking, that we can criticize the Israeli government, but we cannot use the word Zionist, and we cannot criticize the Zionist movement, which means, of course, we cannot criticize the actual activities of the Israeli government in this country. So someone like Elgott is clearly an ideologue for Zionism, has this position in The Guardian, which is very senior, where people aren't really aware that there's a fundamental problematic nature to her approach.
Mm. I mean, we've heard a lot about BICOM, haven't we? I mean, it's often described as a sort of a pro-Israel group. I mean, Would you say that's true, or are there more concrete links with the Israeli embassy?
Well, there are very concrete links with the Israeli embassy, indeed with the State of Israel itself, and indeed with the so-called Israel Defense Forces. The current head of BRICOM is in the reserves of the Israel Defense Forces, which is an extraordinary situation. So when you hear BRICOM speaking, and any of the people who speak on its platforms, like we've seen in the video there, what you're hearing is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Prime Minister's Office and the Israel Defense Forces speaking. This is straightforwardly an arm of the Israeli state.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for a moment, because we've had another report looking at the apparent purge against Palestinian and Arab journalists in the German media.
Germany has a reputation for its refusal to allow open debate on the occupation of Palestine. But recently, disturbing signs of a purge of Arab journalists has emerged. Deutsche Welle is a publicly funded international broadcaster active in 32 languages. It is specifically regulated to be independent of government.
And I think it is time for the people of Germany and German elites to stop making Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip pay for the crimes of the German people against European Jews.
This all began in May 2021 when DW's English language division interviewed Electronic Intifada journalist Ali Abu Nima.
Palestinians are sick of paying the price for guilty German consciences.
The interview prompted an internal crisis at the broadcaster, which issued a public apology and a set of internal reporting guidelines specifying that Germany's path in carrying out the Holocaust means it has a special responsibility towards Israel. The memo banned its journalists from describing Israel as an apartheid state, a description affirmed by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and advising against the term colonialism. In June 2021, Matthias Döpfner, chairman of the German publishing house Axel Springer, who describes himself as a non-Jewish Zionist, told employees who objected to raising the Israeli flag on the building's headquarters to find another job. In December last year, DW suspended its cooperation with Jordanian media partner Roya TV, following the emergence of allegedly anti-Israel comments published on social media by the broadcaster. But recently, the climate became more and more restrictive. In February of this year, 7 journalists were fired and the head of news in the Arabic service resigned. All were Arabs, 6 of them Palestinian. The journalists resolved to take legal action. But it emerged that the investigation report allegedly compiled by experts had been written by individuals with serious conflicts of interest. One in particular was the Palestinian Ahmad Mansour. Mansour is a hardline Islamophobe, given to referring to Arabs as, quote, savages. He has worked with a hardline Likudnik think tank, the European Foundation for Democracy in Brussels, and is a staff member at the Zionist Intelligence Connected Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, occupied Palestine. Palestine Declassified can also reveal that a Deutsche Welle social media editor, Polina Gareev, who has been in post since April 2021, had a previous role in the Zionist entity as news editor of the official IOF magazine, Bamahan. In addition, the current Middle East editor at DW is Jennifer Hollis, previously at the Zionist lobby group, the Israeli-Swiss Association, in occupied Jaffa. Deutsche Welle has trashed its own reputation and shows no sign of independent reporting on Palestine. It's well known that Germany is a hostile place for the Palestinian cause, but recent events emphasize the need for fundamental reform of journalism and the media.
David, I wonder if you could first off start by telling us a little bit about this social media guru, what was her name, Polina Gareev, I think I've pronounced her name correctly.
Yes, so this is something which we've discovered, that I think even the journalists who were sacked at Deutsche Welle weren't aware of, that she had previously worked for the IDF's own magazine, a magazine set up prior to the creation of the State of Israel for the Haganah, the armed group, which was involved centrally in the Nakba. And she also works, I think, for the Israeli The Israel Policy Institute, which, of course, is funded directly by the Israeli state. And this is an extraordinary conflict of interest. And, of course, not one which the German media will be likely to pay much attention to, but which throws a great deal of light on the way in which these journalists have been so shoddily treated. So I think that's a really significant thing. It's the same situation as we've found, effectively, in the British media, that there are Zionist infiltrators, effectively, throughout the mainstream media. And Deutsche Welle, I remember, is a public broadcaster, like the German equivalent of the BBC World Service. It's supposed to be independent of states. And they've sacked all these journalists, seven journalists sacked, one of them resigned, and they've got these other people in there, like Paulina and several others, who used to work directly for the Zionist movement or the Israeli state. Extraordinary.
Talking about conflicts of interest, what about this character, Ahmed Mansour, that was mentioned in the film? He seems to have a very significant conflict of interest, doesn't he?
Well, we come back again, don't we, to the same issue we had with the British media, which is that there is this network of hawkish think tanks which are pushing people forward to be experts in the media, which are issuing statements and which are, you know, trying to infiltrate the media institutions themselves. I mean, the connections he has there with the European Foundation for Democracy, which is a hard-line Likudnik think tank in Brussels, which is funded almost entirely by the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C., which is itself, as admitted by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, an asset, an agent, effectively, of the government in Yaffa. So there's a real issue there. He's also been associated with the IDC, the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which, of course, has a strong connection to both elite special forces in the IDF and indeed to the Israeli intelligence services. Something like 20% of places are reserved for such people to go to this university. So this is a person who is well connected straight to the Israeli state and who is performing a role of a kind of state-sanctioned Islamophobe, going around condemning Arabs as savages and trying to suggest that Arab journalists are anti-Semitic. Now, there's no such thing going on here. What we're seeing is an attempt to intimidate and occupy public service broadcasters and indeed the private press to make sure that there can be no criticism of the state of Israel.
And Ramzi, I mean, obviously the situation in Germany is pretty dire. I mean, do you think that the United States is more open to dissent on Palestine, maybe, than Germany is?
Well, I think there are the historical sensitivities that are, at work in Germany makes the nature of the conversation there, I mean, stifles it all together. The points that Ali Abu Naima raised is really something quite serious, and they have to be considered and they have to be at the core of this discussion. But of course, that is just simply impossible in Germany. And I personally experienced in both Germany and Austria particular situations in which, you know, I had talks canceled, venues canceling on me last minute. And one particular visit to Austria, four different venues canceled on me. And we had to scramble into a cafe shop last minute to bring people there to speak about Palestine. So the very idea of discussing Palestine within a sympathetic point of view in these countries is problematic. So this is something that goes beyond media into civil society, into academia, and into other venues. Now, in the United States, is different business. Again, because you have this massive infrastructure of think tanks that have been at work for a long time, particularly after 9/11 also, we have kind of seen this amalgamation of narratives where basically Israel became an American platform to fight terrorism, so-called terrorism, and the way that Israel played so very well on this particular aspect. You have characters, for example, like Daniel Pletschka from the American Enterprise Institute, one of many institutes, but people like her, her connections and friendships with Netanyahu and other members of the U.S. Israeli government, but also her relationship and connections to the American ruling elites, particularly within the neoconservative movement. And we know how the neocons and the Israelis have worked so very well together. And yet, when they appear on American media, whether Fox or CNBC or even CNN, they are not seen as people who represent Israel, per se, or Israeli point of view. They come across as normal, concerned American intellectuals, academics, analysts, and they offer a point of view that is supposedly uncorrupted by these kind of sinister connections. And this is what we really have to deal with here at quite often. I mean, you might find this is quite strange, but when I first came to the UK years and years ago, I was actually impressed with how British media, once in a while, allowed some kind of a Palestinian or sympathetic Palestinian voice, to the point that my British friends would say, what are you talking about? They are ridiculously biased. And of course, it took me time to understand that within the British context. But the way that the reason I felt that is here in America, we are completely erased. We are completely marginalized to the point that if you are as a Palestinian or a pro-Palestinian voice to get published in a respected American newspaper, you would have to watch everything you say. You would have to water down your language to the point that almost the language becomes emasculated. And in fact, this is the reason of why I veered off completely in a sort of chasing after the Washington Post and the New York Times to publish an article once a year or two or three. We invested more in alternative media, because that's really the only way that you can reach even the margins of American audiences and society. But it is far more beneficial and rewarding process than actually try to get the American media to pay any heed to your point of view.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Ramsey. But thank you very much indeed. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We could have gone on, obviously, for a lot longer. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The ongoing attempts to take over Muslim holy places, whether in Al-Quds, Al-Khalil, or in Nablus, continue apace, as does valiant Palestinian resistance to them, says Joseph Massad, journalist, in an article published under the heading How Zionism is Fueling a Religious War Over Al-Aqsa Mosque. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist Jewish colonial fundamentalist group, the Returning to the Mount, which advocates the construction of a third Jewish temple in Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest place in Islam, and is associated with the racist Catch group, announced recently that it plans to sacrifice animals as part of the Jewish Passover rituals on Friday, April 15th, in Haram al-Sharif. In response, Hamas declared that it will not allow such rituals to take place and will prevent them at any cost. The Palestinian Authority and the Jordanian government also condemned the plans. Palestinian worshippers insisted on remaining in the mosque recently to prevent the extremist Zionist group from entering Al-Haram and were attacked by the Zionist regime forces, who injured more than 100 Palestinian worshippers. Just before 2003, the Zionist regime began to allow no more than three religious Jews to visit Al-Haram at a time, but since then has steadily increased that number to more than 50, and does so without the approval of the Islamic Waqf authorities. By 2009, after making racist remarks about Palestinians, the Zionist regime's internal security minister, Yitzhak Aharonovich of the right-wing Yisrael Beitenu party, paid yet another visit to Al-Haram. More Zionist provocations and desecrations continued. In September 2015, the Zionist regime prevented Palestinians from entering Al-Haram to make way for Jews to go and pray there. A Palestinian uprising ensued in which the Zionist regime police shot a score of Palestinians, whereas the Zionist regime banned members of the Knesset from visiting Al-Haram. Following the uprising, Benjamin Netanyahu lifted the ban in 2018. In fact, the issue of whether Jews are allowed to enter, let alone pray at Al-Haram al-Sharif, remains a major point of contention in Jewish religious circles in the occupied territories, so much so that last year Netanyahu was rumored to have concluded a deal with a conservative rabbi and head of a political party to temporarily bar Jews from entering Al-Haram in exchange for joining his coalition cabinet. The ongoing Palestinian resistance against the Zionist colonialism of the past few weeks, whether in the occupied territories or in the West Bank and Gaza, has reached a fever pitch, with Israeli killings of Palestinians across the West Bank, especially in Jenin. While Palestinians realize that settler colonialism has targeted and continues to target the entire land of the Palestinians, the ongoing attempts to take over Palestinian Muslim holy places, whether in Al-Quds, Al-Khalil, or in Nablus, Maqam Yusuf al-Daq, a local saint, or what Zionist zealots allege in the biblical Joseph tomb, continue rapidly, as does valiant Palestinian resistance to them. While the Israelis had been corralling their supporters among Arab leaders in the last month, whether the Jordanian government to pressure the Palestinian Authority to repress any possible uprising during the current holy month of Ramadan, or the Egyptian government to warn Hamas not to engage the Zionist regime as it represses West Bank and East Al-Quds Palestinians, the next couple of weeks may see such schemes falter. Palestinian resistance and uprising against the settler colony have not ceased since the first arrival of Jewish colonists in the 1880s. The Zionist regime can call upon whatever Arab leaders it wants to help it quell Palestinian protests, but there is no reason to believe that the Palestinians will ever stop resisting as long as Zionist settler colonialism remains.
Insight. Good evening and welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Yemen in a conversation with Ibrahim Al-Daylami, Yemen's ambassador to Iran. But first, this brief analysis.
Yemen is an ancient civilization located strategically at the crossroads between east and west on the Bab al-Mandab, the naval choke point connecting the Indian Ocean to the Red Sea. Anyone wanting to travel by sea between Asia and East Africa and Europe has to pass by Yemen. This strategic location has made Yemen an object desire for empires old and new. In modern times, it was first the Ottomans which occupied the country, and then later, after the construction of the Suez Canal, connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, the British established a crown colony and a protectorate centered around the southern port city of Aden. The Aden Protectorate was one of the very last British colonies to gain its independence in 1967, following a bloody uprising by the local Yemeni population. And it is quite possible that the British would still be in Yemen today if not for the militant uprising by the Yemeni people, which expelled the British. During the Cold War, the country was divided between North and South Yemen, one allied with the Western Bloc and the other allied with the Eastern Bloc. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990, and after a series of conflicts between the two Yemeni states, Yemen was reunified under the leadership of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been ruling the north since 1978. And this unified Yemen allowed the US to maintain a significant security presence in the country under the excuse of fighting terror. But in fact, it was because of the old need to control the Bab al-Mandab and to strategically deny it to anybody else, including the Yemeni people to whom this area belongs. At the same time, America's vassal, Saudi Arabia, was spending vast sums to establish Wahhabi and Takfiri-inspired schools and political parties in Yemen to change the delicate social balance between the Shia Zaydis and Ismailis on the one hand, and Sunnis who predominantly followed the Shafi'i school of law on the other hand, which had existed for centuries. After years of discrimination and provocations by the Saudi-backed Salafis and the assassination of the Zaydi leader Hussein al-Houthi, the Zaydis began an uprising against the Western-backed central government in 2004. This continued until 2011, which saw a general uprising in the country against the decades-old rule of Saleh as part of the wave of revolutionary uprisings in the Arab countries at that time. During the revolution, the Houthis liberated the capital Sana'a in 2014 and took over the government and the Western and Saudi-backed government, now led by Saleh's former deputy, Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi, who resigned and fled to Aden. This triggered a military invasion by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, with air force, intelligence and logistics support by the US and the UK, again in the name of fighting terror. But actually, in order to maintain control of the Bab al-Mandab and not to allow it to fall under the control of the popular revolutionary government. Contrary to initial assessments by Western experts, the Saudis were decisively beaten by the Yemenis, and the Americans now gave the Emiratis the mission to secure southern Yemen, this time with the direct help by American special forces and American mercenary companies famous for committing war crimes in Iraq and Syria. These forces even began to attack the Saudi-backed Hadi forces in that region. Currently, there is an attempt to once again split Yemen in two, with the south being a Western puppet state, nominally backed by the Emirates. Beyond the daily horror of the Yemen war, which even the usually lame United Nations has called the greatest humanitarian crisis of this century, the war in Yemen is ultimately being fought about two fundamental principles. First, the Yemeni people controlling their nation's sovereignty and its strategic choke point without the US and other powers interfering. Second, and more importantly, the attempt by the Yemeni people to establish a popular republic where the rulers are chosen by the people, which will then serve as a living model for the people living under Western-backed family dictatorships in the neighboring countries of Yemen, such as Saudi Arabia. Maybe this is the key to understanding the bloodthirsty behavior of the US and the UK, who continue to kill, maim, bomb, and starve millions of people in Yemen through their Saudi and Emirati proxies. The absolute need to prevent the idea and living model of a popular government backed by local populations being a replacement for Western-backed family dictatorships, and the daily dose of murder and mayhem required to implement this policy, has once again revealed the true evil nature of those Westerners who hypocritically claim and cynically advocate universal peace and human rights, but who engage in the absolute opposite when it comes to places such as Yemen.
Welcome to Insight. Tonight, we will be discussing Yemen with Yemen's ambassador in Iran, Mr. Ibrahim Al-Daylami. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for coming on to Insight. As you know, our program tries to look at the historic and strategic background of the news and the events that occur. And so with that in mind, I would like to talk about the Yemen and the war in Yemen and the events surrounding the crisis that exists in Yemen from that perspective, from a historic and a strategic perspective. And I would like to start maybe talking about the fact, the geography of Yemen, the fact that it is located in a strategically very important part of the world, Bab al-Mandab, the area that connects the east with the west, that connects the Indian Ocean and Asia with Europe and Africa. And we see that historically, the great powers, the imperialist powers throughout history have always tried to control Yemen, and particularly the south, Aden and the areas that are on the coast. And we see that this is happening again. We had the Ottomans for a period trying to control it. After the Ottomans, we had the British establishing a colony in Aden. And during the Cold War, we saw that Yemen was divided between the south and the north. And, of course, both sides of the Cold War, the Soviets and the Americans supporting different sides. So this idea that Yemen has to be split up, it has to be divided so that they can control it, is not a new thing in history. And recently we saw that after the revolution, the Americans again tried, through the Saudis and Mansour Hadi, to maintain that control. When that didn't work, when the Saudis were defeated and their Yemeni proxies were defeated, they switched to the Emirates, supporting the Emirates, and through the Emirates, again, reviving this idea of separating the south from Yemen. Occupying Aden, occupying Socotra, the islands, even entering into the war in Marib. Again, we have the U.S., the Emirates, and then this idea of splitting the south away from Yemen in order to control Bab al-Mandab. My question is this. Does the revolutionary government, would the revolutionary government in any shape or form accept a splitting of Yemen, or is the territorial integrity of Yemen a non-negotiable issue?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. في البداية أتوجه بالشكر الجزيل لحضرتكم على إتاحة.
In the name of God, thank you very much for having me and giving me this opportunity. Other parts of the world who are connected to the aggressors on Yemen, a war that continues for 8 years, they want to loot Yemen. They want to divide this country, but not just to two states, but more small parts. That's what they really want at the moment, and that's because of the important location of Yemen. This country is near the Arabian Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the Horn of Africa. As you know, we have a long border with Saudi Arabia and Oman. From the very beginning of the war, the aggressors aimed at implementing the splitting of Yemen. But we, the revolutionary government, which was formed in 2014, we knew it from the beginning, all those aspects and their intentions. As a result, we knew that it is our responsibility to confront their aggressions and foil all their plans, and we are still resisting. It is a clear decision, as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi stated many times, that this confrontation is our national responsibility and religious duty to stand against this aggression and dismantle any plans to separate the south from the north of Yemen. This resistance, in fact, needs political endeavors in order to continue and end the defeat of aggressors. As you know, one of the main goals of the Yemeni nation, beside ending the siege, is to push all the foreigners and their troops to leave Yemen, not only the Saudis and Emiratis, but the Americans and Zionists. We have to stop all these aggressions and attempts to interfere in Yemen's affairs. We have already told the world countries that these wars will not be limited to Yemen. As you know, and as you must have heard in the news, the enemy is targeting all countries in the region: Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and of course Palestine. I mean in the West Bank and Gaza. We should not also forget what happened in Sudan in a couple of years ago, which is now divided into two countries. Libya is also facing the same fate. This must wake us up about the aim of the enemy, particularly the U.S. and its puppets, which are unfortunately some Arab countries in the region.
Well, it's very interesting, Mr. Ambassador. You pointed out that, in fact, you have a presence, a direct presence by the Americans, by the Zionists. Some have said even some British forces directly on the ground. Of course, it's done under the flag of somebody else. It's done in a form that's maybe not that apparent. But let's talk a little bit about what they've done. So one of the things they've done is they have occupied Socotra, which is a very important strategic island. And so with the flag of the Emirates, they come and they take it over. But immediately afterwards, you see American Marines, you see Israeli forces coming in. They're even bringing some tourists from Israel now and making some claims about, oh, we have this old historic connection with the Emirates. And, of course, the minute they saw that Aden might fall out of their hands with the Ansar Allah and the revolutionary government being able to take it over, they immediately started attacking the Hadi forces. So there was even fighting among themselves, those forces, one backed by the Saudis, one backed by the Emiratis. I want you to please explain for our viewers this fact. This is something which is not properly explained in other media, in Western media, that it's not simply about everybody against, for example, Ansar Allah, everybody against the revolutionary government. It's everybody against everybody. There is a scramble. There is a attempt. Everybody wants to bring in their own people and try to control Yemen. The only people that are the Yemeni people who are actually doing it is the revolutionary government. That is not somebody else's puppet who is trying to take over Yemen. If you could please explain that a little bit more in detail for our audience.
Before answering to this question, let me point to something very important. Prior to the revolution, there were American troops in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. They were present there under the pretext of helping American diplomats in Sana'a. There were so many American troops there. The most significant thing that happened was sending the Americans out of the biggest military base in the Arabian Peninsula, which had been built by the Soviet at the time. That was the most significant achievement by the revolutionary government. There is an attempt to pretend that the crisis in Yemen is rooted in domestic and internal differences among the Yemenis themselves. The UN Security Council in 2016, intentionally, in a conspiracy with world powers, tried to convince the public opinion of the world that the crisis in Yemen is a Yemeni conflict. But the fact is that the crisis in Yemen comes from efforts of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and beyond them, the British and Americans and Zionists and some others. They are not defending Yemen. So I think this background gives an insight to the viewers that Yemen's enemies are trying to tell the world that this crisis is a domestic affair. But in fact, it is the Americans and the Brits which have caused all this chaos using their tools, that is Saudi Arabia and the UAE and other mercenaries. At the beginning, they claimed that they wanted to help, But now they're trying to topple down a legitimate government in Yemen. We know United Arab Emirates and its government. We know it is not an Arab country with colonial intentions, but at the same time, it has turned into a tool at the hands of colonial powers, the powers which want to have easy access to strategic gates such as Bab al-Mandab and the Red Sea for implementing big projects. The Zionist regime and the U.S. want that for their projects against North Korea, China, Russia, and the resistance movement which is being led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think this background gives us a very clear image about this conspiracy which is beyond Yemen. They want to divide the region and split it into smaller pieces in order to bring new Daesh or ISIS in the area and in the world. At the beginning, it was very difficult for the Yemenis to prove this fact for the world. But currently, I think with this long duration of aggression, I think most of the Islamic Arab countries and Muslim nations have noticed this conspiracy and the roots of this conspiracy. This conspiracy is bigger than Yemen. We as Yemenis, we don't have any other option but resisting and moving forward until we bring full independence to all Yemen, not to just one small part of it. We will not pay attention to what is being said in the mainstream media about Ansarullah. They are spreading lies about Ansarullah. Ansarullah is not alone in its resistance against the aggressions. All the Yemeni nation are confronting this aggression. Everyone must know that this is our responsibility. Every Yemeni feels the same. Maybe Ansarullah was alone at the beginning, but not today. Since all the Yemeni people are facing the same situation, we as officials are holding this responsibility to move ahead and not to stop. We will continue the resistance as long as we send all aggressors out of Yemeni soil. We will expel them out of Yemen, and then the revolutionary government will form a national government in Yemen.
I want to first come to the issue of the relationship between the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic, and then later, continuing in what you were mentioning, I want to talk about, you know, us thinking a little bit about how it's going to be after the war and the situation, inshallah, after the war. So let's first talk about the relationship between the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic. As you know, the propaganda media in the West always portrays the situation where they say, oh, the revolutionary government is a puppet of Iran, is a proxy of Iran. It does whatever Iran says. And the interesting thing, the funny thing is that both the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic say, no, that's not the case. So please clarify for us once and for all, what is the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolutionary government? Does the revolutionary government take its orders from the Islamic Republic, or is it a relationship that is between two friends, two brothers that are equal, and they not a relationship like you have, for example, with the Yemenis that are working with the Saudis or the Emiratis?
We know that the U.S. makes decisions for some Arab countries and for some EU countries and for some African countries and Latin Americans and some Asian countries. They have military presence in many areas. And of course, they claim the opposite and keep saying that they're not doing this and that. And now, in order to defeat the public opinion of the world, they are announcing that Iran is a colonial power and has colonial presence in Yemen. They use their media power for spreading their lies. But the fact is that the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolutionary government of Yemen is a brotherhood relationship, a friendly one between two Muslim nations and two Muslim governments. And I can say that the Islamic Republic of Iran is the only country which has stood against the aggressions of Saudi and American governments against Yemen from the first day. Iran has helped us since day one and shouted that the siege against Yemen